Chat with Traders, episode 77.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
This episode is sponsored by an award-winning online broker, TradeStation. One reason why I really like TradeStation is because they actually do equip their clients with remarkable technology across desktop, web, and mobile. Their market monitoring, charting, and analysis tools are designed to give you an advantage in competitive markets. So while you enjoy this episode, visit TradeStation.com to learn more about why traders trade with TradeStation. Again, that's TradeStation.com. How you doing, guys? You're listening to episode 77, and I am your host, Aaron Fifield. As per usual, thank you for being here. Now, what you're about to listen to is a really interesting conversation I had with Dennis Dick. For a little context, Dennis first started out meddling with penny stocks before soon joining a well-established prop firm known as Bright Trading. This was in the late 90s. Now, astute listeners may actually pick up on the fact that this was also where Jeff Davis from episode 70 got his start too. To this day, Dennis remains with the same firm, still as an active short-term equities trader, but also as their market structure analyst. And if his voice sounds somewhat familiar, that's probably because he's the co-host of Ben Zinger's Pre-Market Prep live morning show. Some of the key talking points that come up over the next 60 minutes here include scalping. Is it still a viable strategy? Surviving as a short-term trader in a high-frequency world, various order types and the pros and cons of those, and the opportunities that can be found trading the open, because this is actually where Dennis makes roughly 50% of his money each day within the first 5 minutes. All right, traders, I hope you enjoy this episode. Here is my chat with Dennis Dick. Just pretty much things that we spoke about the other week, you know, how you came up as a trader, prop trading, how you trade today, particularly around the open and after hours, and also really keen to speak to you about some market structure topics as well, seeing as you're a market structure analyst. So how does that sound?
Yeah, sounds perfect. I tend to go on tangents, so I guess if we go on a few tangents there, those make it interesting as well. So
yeah, no, that sounds good. That sounds good. So yeah, feel free to do that. I mean, we're keen to hear what you've got to say. So let's just start it off. So the first question I'd like to ask you is, how did you get started? Like, what was it about trading that got you interested?
I was trading my parents' money in university. So my parents had a stockbroker, and I was taking finance in university. So I started getting interested in the stock market and started playing the penny stocks. I think everybody starts with penny stocks, it seems like. But there was, you know, a couple of penny stocks. There were advisories, newsletters, email newsletters, and it was interesting to me. Like I'd see these newsletter come in my inbox, and you know, I didn't know at the time, but it was basically just a pump and dump scam. But looking back on it, in 1997, so I'm going back 20 years ago, you'd get these emails, and they basically would be just trying to pump a stock, and you'd look at the stock, and you'd get the email the night before, and you'd see it the next day, and it would go up, and you're like, holy cow, you know, this newsletter is awesome. They're literally, you know, sending me information on a stock, and it's going up the next day, but really it's just because they're sending it to thousands and thousands of people, and it's actually pumping up the price of the stock, looking in hindsight. But that got me interested just in the markets, you know, just playing the penny stocks and seeing how everything moved. So I was starting to trade my parents' money, and I was just trading basically during the internet bubble. So they gave me a little bit of money to play with, and just by sheer luck, and just because of the environment we were in, it seemed like everything that I would buy would make money because it was in such a raging bull market. Like, I can remember stocks, you know, that are probably long gone now, but like Excite at Home and these other search engines that were trading publicly. And, you know, these stocks would, you know, go up tenfold in a year. Like the tech bubble of the NASDAQ was really something. So that's kind of how, you know, what spurred my interest. And I was just trading retail then, obviously, my parents' money. And then I graduated from university, and instead of getting a real job, I had a friend who was trading at Bright Trading in Detroit, Michigan. And I was Canadian, so there was going to be a little bit of to-do with visas to go across the border and that. But I worked that out and actually went over and met the office manager there, who, coincidentally, I've been with, for a long time now. I now do a radio show with him, Joel Alakonin. And I met him, and there really wasn't much to it back then. This was 1999. There wasn't any licensing or anything that was necessary. So I went in and just interviewed with him, and I saw the trading office. There was like maybe 12 or 13 guys trading in there. And I was like, this is fantastic. So you had to have $25,000 to trade upright trading. So you put that $25,000 performance, that deposit into your account. And then that was the money that your losses or your gains would go to. So with that $25,000, they would give you access to the firm capital, and that could be upwards to $500,000 to $1 million. So you really got by. If you were on a retail account, imagine trying to use $25,000 to make a living. It would be impossible. But that $25,000, now that you have access to the firm's money, can make you a lot of money. So, and obviously that capital, you can employ a lot of different strategies as opposed to, buying one or two stocks. You can employ a plethora of strategies when you've got access to $500,000. So that's how I got started, upright trading in 1999. And it's now 2016, 17 years later, and I'm still upright trading. So.
That's awesome. That's a really cool way to kick this off. So I've got to ask you, were you ever nervous trading your parents' money?
Yeah, for sure. Even back when I was retail, but not so much. Like, I think I wasn't nervous because in the beginning it just seemed like everything worked. And like I said, looking back in hindsight, it was just the market environment we were in. The NASDAQ was going straight up. Everything was going straight up. So you bought some little tech stock and it just went up. So it seemed like, I was very confident going in, because really I didn't have a lot of losing trades. So, but I can remember when I first started upright and I was trading with my parents I actually borrowed the $25,000 from my parents to start upright trading. And I can remember being nervous then. So, and starting up right, and it was kind of completely different. I remember actually on my second day of trading, and you're trying to get used to the interface. I trade on, it's Goldman Sachs Ready Plus platform, and that's what we were trading on back then as well. And I remember you're just trying to get used to it, and I accidentally, what you could do is if you click in the montage and you click on the offer, your order entry window automatically populates. And it would populate with the size of, of what you clicked on. So I accidentally clicked on a 2,000 share order, and I accidentally bought 2,000 shares of Microsoft. I wanted to buy 100 shares of Microsoft. So now I'm thinking, whoa, I'm trying to buy 100 shares of, $100 stock. I just bought 2,000 shares. And I can remember trembling at the mouse. I was literally shaking at the mouse. I'm a 22-year-old kid here, and I just, on my second day of trading, I've just thrown $200,000 on Microsoft, which, we were in the tech bubble. Microsoft really moved a lot back then, so that was a big position. And I quickly got out of it, and I think I actually ended up scratching the trade. So no damage on that, but then I had to sit back and whoa. Sit back and really analyze and, make sure you learn how to use the configuration and everything of the platform before you just start clicking randomly. So very dangerous when you're, in a prop account. If you're in a retail account, there's like a confirmation window. There's something different happening. So, you make an accident. Now you have a confirmation screen. It's like, oh, no, I didn't want to do that. And, in Goldman Sachs Ready Plus, you click you own. So it's that quick. So it's a little bit different, but that trade actually didn't end up breaking me, but I can remember my first week I made like a little bit of money just by luck, and then I remember my second week there, and I just was losing on everything. I think I had the office record. I lost on 17 consecutive trades, and I'm like, how? If you think about it, trading really is kind of like 50-50. I mean, if you're buying, it could go up or it can go down. How do you statistically lose on 17 trades in a row? You're doing something really bad. I'm like, holy cow, I'm really bad at this. So, but it didn't deter me, and I stuck with it and slowly started to learn, the different systems. And we were kind of playing market maker back then and learning how it goes. And after 6 months, I started to become profitable. So it was a little bit of a learning curve to it, but I did gain the profitability. I never really lost that much money. The most I ever got down, I think, in my trading account was about $3,500 on the 25 grand. So I never really got down that much. And that was because I really followed, Bray Trading's lessons. They're like, trade with 100 shares. You trade with 100 shares, you can last a long time. Because a good day, you might make $200. A bad day, you might lose $200. But it's not like you're going to blow your account out in one day.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to dig into a few things you've said there a little bit more. So just backing up a little bit, what were some of the advantages you saw at the time by joining a prop firm? Like, why did you decide to go into the prop industry instead of continuing to trade as a retail trader?
Big advantages back then. The advantages aren't as much as they used to be now because we've had the internet. There's so much advancement with retail brokers that you probably can do a lot of stuff that we do now through a retail broker. The biggest advantage back then was just the speed. So we had T1 connection, which was everything back then. So you're getting the information faster. You can send your orders directly into the system where you literally, like in my and obviously in your first 6 months of trading, you're still learning. But in my first few years of trading, I was basically just trading the news. And we were the fastest. So when news would break, like I can remember even, for instance, if there's a Fed decision at 2:15, they're always at 2 o'clock now Eastern, but they used to be at 2:15 back then. And they're raising interest rates. So we'd have like spreadsheets to go to buy like all, a whole pile of the S&P components. And they would sit there for a few seconds. Like it wasn't like high frequency trading is now where it's gone in milliseconds. Those opportunities were there for seconds and that was everything. And we were fast. So you could, literally pick off, anybody who's sitting out there with a limit order that's, they're kind of like a sitting duck, and we're just picking those off. So, and basically making the money from, because those orders that are sitting out there aren't priced for the new information that, hey, they just lowered interest rates, so everything's going to go higher. So, so that was the number one advantage was the speed. The second advantage, which I talked briefly about at the beginning of the interview, is the capital. So, like I said, if you're trading retail and if you're a 2-to-1 margin or 4-to-1 margin intraday, it's hard to make a living with a $25,000 account. If you even say you had 4-to-1 margin, that's 100 grand. Well, you got to do 10% on your money. You're only going to make $10,000. You're not going to live very well on 10 grand. So that's why, that access to capital was key too. So, and obviously the other big thing is at a retail broker, you have a ticket charge. And the ticket charge is that $7.99 a trade or $10.99 a trade or $5 a trade. No ticket charges at Bright. It's just flat out, well, now it's profit sharing, but back then it was commission based. So we'd pay 1 cent a share. So if I'm buying something, and it was in fractions back then too, so if I'm buying a stock on the NYSE at 25 1/4, and I sell it for 25 5/16, I'm actually going to make 6 1/4 cents minus my 2 cents. I'm pocketing 4 1/4 minus little SEC fees in there. I'm clearing 4 cents for sure. So, on a minimum tick, which was, a 16th back then, I'm making money. You wouldn't be doing that at a retail broker. The ticket charges would kill you. So that's the difference is that it's, there's no ticket charge at a prop firm.
Okay. And I just want to pick up on some of the terminology you said in your response there. Can you just expand on what you mean by picking off?
Okay. So this, if you have a limit order that is sitting out there, and this is going back to like if you want to talk like, it's like adverse selection risk is what it really is. So an adverse selection is just the risk that your order is going to not price in the information fast enough, then another trader might be able to take your order. So for instance, let's just use the example that I cited earlier where you had the Fed decision. So there will be orders sitting on the limit order book at any given time. There's going to be bids and asks on there's going to be buy orders out there and sell orders out there. So if all of a sudden the S&P futures drop 10 points because of a Fed decision at 2:15, that's all of a sudden all those buy orders that are sitting on the limit order book are mispriced because they were out there before that information was there, before that information of the interest rate rise or the interest rate decision was publicly available. Once that information becomes publicly available, then what you have is, and you'll see this in the high frequency trading world, that they'll come in and obviously take out whatever is down there. So if the S&P futures fall 10 points, that means all your S&P components, for the most part, like obviously as a whole, are going to drop by that percentage. So it might be easier to say in percentage. Let's just say, hypothetically, for simplicity purposes, S&P futures drop 1%. The S&P 500 components as a whole have to drop 1% as well. It didn't do that instantaneously, though, in 1999. It took a few seconds for that to happen. So what we would do is if, General Electric was bidding $25.50 before this information came out, S&P futures all of a sudden fall 1%. There's still a 25.50 bid sitting there. I'm going to hit that 25.50 bid because it's mispriced now for the new information that was just given to the market. I'm going to probably hit the 25.45 bid, probably the 25.40 bid as well if it's there. And then, you know, watch, you know, as other traders come in and the arbitrage comes in and reprices G possibly down to 25.25 or, you know, 25.30 cents lower or maybe approximately 1% lower because its beta is approximately 1 for that interest rate or that movement in the S&P futures. So basically, I was just playing the arbitrage of the S&P components versus the actual tradable futures contract, which is the, you know, obviously the 500 components combined. And now the difference is why you can't do that now is high-frequency traders are repricing that in milliseconds. So that's why speed is so important to high-frequency traders because they're trying to beat the other high-frequency traders. So, you know, really, you know, in the evolution of the markets, they're just doing exactly what we were doing manually in 1999 or, you know, obviously on the floor before that as well. They were doing the same thing. It was just a lot slower. Now it's been sped up and it's so quick that all those, you know, microseconds matter.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and we'll pick back up on that in a little bit as well. I'm keen to hear more about your views on HFT and that sort of thing. I know you're, you've commented on that regularly. So just continuing with the prop firm, what were some of the things that they taught you as you joined the firm and some of the things they taught you in terms of like trading methods? Did you just continue trading the way you had been trading when you were more a retail guy, or did they teach you some new ways of trading that you actually put into practice?
I think both. I think I learned a lot on the job too, and I kind of put my own spin on a lot of things. But Bright Trading is great, and they're still great like that. They do conference calls every morning. We used to do them every morning to talk with our traders and, you know, discuss, you know, what's today's action, what are we seeing today. And they would do a regular, you could go out to Las Vegas, regular trading workshops. Now we have them online because it's just simpler, but back then people would actually fly in and you'd learn different strategies, and some traders would share strategies, some wouldn't. I've always been one that, you know, from my own personal, I would share any strategy that's capital intensive. If it wasn't capital intensive, I wouldn't probably share it. That even goes for the radio show that I do at Benzinga. I always share the capital intensive stuff because if there's more, you know, if I don't want all the action, there's more for everybody, you know, that's fine. But, you know, if I'm in some little strategy or some little small cap stock where everybody else is going to matter, then that's a strategy I probably wouldn't share. So I think that's probably, you know, the traders at Bright probably follow that mentality a little bit where they might share some of the more capital intensive stuff and overall strategies. But Bright themselves was great. We had Don Bright who passed away a couple of years ago, but he had a strategy called the opening OPG strategy, which was the opening only order strategy. And that's a strategy that I still employ today. And it was basically always, if you just talk back to 1999, it was a strategy that tried to put you on the same side as the specialist, the guy on the floor. They call those guys designated market makers now, but back then there was a specialist that was running each stock. And on the NYSE in 1999, 80 or 90% of your order flow went through that guy. So if you, and you know, he's trading, but he's also trading his own account as well. So if you can trade on the same side as him, it's a definitive advantage. And what Don Bright had figured out is, you know, when a stock is opening too high or too low, relative to fair value or where, you know, the pricing should be, the specialist would often have to provide liquidity to that. So if a stock was opening too high, for instance, specialist would provide liquidity to that by selling the stock short of the extra shares, or if the stock was opening too low, specialist might have to come in and provide liquidity by buying the shares. Well, if you're, you know, if the specialist just buy the guy on the floor who has the order book and all the information, because that wasn't public back then, the order book, the specialist held that book on his own, if he's buying the stock, you probably want to be buying the stock. So we traded a lot just trying to figure out which side the specialist was on. That was even through my regular tape reading. I would be trying to figure out, okay, is the specialist long or short here? Because he's probably going to try his best to push the stock higher. Now, they have rules. They can't just physically come in and start buying the stock up. But they can buy stock from the sales and then naturally let the order flow take it higher. So And the bottom line is there was a big advantage back then to figuring out which side of the trade the specialist was on and trading along with him. And that's all short-term trading. Like, our trades were typically, you know, in minutes or even seconds. You know, we weren't in trades for hours. We were scalping.
Got it. Okay. So one of the things you said a little bit earlier was that you were pretty much profitable, like consistently profitable, within about 6 months, like within your first year of trading. I mean, that's pretty abnormal, you know, when, especially from my experience talking with traders, that they actually become profitable within the first year. How do you think you were able to pick it up so quickly? I know you'd had a little bit of experience, you know, on the retail side before coming into the prop firm, but even still, it seems as though you picked up trading fairly quickly compared to most. What do you think? Why do you think that was?
1999. That's why it was. It was a lot easier back then because the evolution of the markets, you just got to think of, you know, what's happened. So it's come from the floor, and it is in its infancy in 1999 when I started. It's just getting started at the computers. So we, you know, are fast enough where we're sending orders or doing stuff like that. We have so many advantages over even the floor traders back then. Like, really, when I think about it, Bright Trading and firms like ours were your first high-frequency traders. We really were. You know, we were employing the same strategies that they employ today. They just do them faster. So they did all this stuff on the floor beforehand. So it was just the evolution of taking these strategies from the floor and coming to the computer, and we were at the beginning of it. So the reason, you know, that I was doing so well in 1999 was because it was just a lot easier back then. We were quicker. We were the fastest traders. We were picking off the uninformed order flow that wasn't priced for all the correct information. And that's exactly what high-frequency traders are doing today. So, you know, it's just changed a lot. You know, and coming back, you know, you could ask me this later, but I think, you know, a better question for me is probably why, how am I still profitable today in this environment, you know, not trading any of the strategies that I used to trade? Because back then it was kind of like shooting ducks in a barrel, to be honest. I can remember, you know, there's traders in the office that wouldn't have a losing day the entire year. So, and that was just simply just the information advantage, trading on news and being quicker than the next guy. And I'm sure a lot of your high-frequency traders, you hear about stuff like this, how Virtue or, you know, or different high-frequency traders don't have any losing days. And I get that. You know, they're not cheating. It's just this is, when you're trading and you have a statistical edge, and let's say it's like 55% or 53%, if you employ that edge enough times during a day, there's a very, very low probability that you're going to lose money on any given day. So, you know, so that's why, you know, I think I was able to pick it up back then. It's just, it was a lot easier back then. Trading is a lot more difficult for a human being now because of all that high-frequency competition.
Right. So at what point did, how do I say this? At what point did the high-speed traders force you into trading higher time frames? Like you said that you were trading sometimes, your trades would be over and done within a matter of seconds.
Yeah.
You know, I know as time went by, you sort of got forced out of that space and began trading, you know, minutes to sometimes hours as the years went by. What point did that start to happen, and how did you, I guess, notice that?
It was after the financial crisis. So we're talking 2008, 2009. I would say in 2010 is when it really started to hit us. So I'm, you know, 11 years of, you know, basically probably being the fastest. And we had automation too. So like I said, you know, we were those initial high frequency traders where we're trading automated, we're speed. But then, you know, it's moved to co-location and it's just got sped up and kind of taken away from us, you know, and now there's off-exchange trades, all kinds of other stuff, you know, where there's definitive advantages over there. But it all really started, I would say, like some people say Reagan MS, you know, 2006, I think it was. But it was probably, maybe that was the infancy of it, but really when it started, we started to feel a pinch, where, you know, okay, we got to start adjusting some strategies, is 2010. I used to run a manual trading system, and I had a second account. And my second account was fully automated. So I could totally, you know, and this was probably 2004. So, you know, when I'm fully automated in 2004, I'm way ahead of the curve, you know, from where we were today. So I can remember my automated account would make money every day. You know, 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, it got interesting because of the financial crisis. I wasn't running as much automation in the financial crisis because it was a different environment. But in 2006, 2000, you know, 2005, 2006, those were relatively stable years. I was running different, you know, automated, like, market-making type systems. those systems would make money every day. And, you know, and now, you know, that's kind of how I understand high-frequency trading so well. You know, maybe not the minutiae of, you know, how the speed all works, but I understand the strategies because it's my strategies. You know, they're using our strategies, you know, and not that we created them, but traders like us were using those same strategies, which were taken from the floor originally. It's all, you know, market-making strategies there. So, you know, in 2006, 2007, you know, and then you're trying to run automation in 2009, 2010, and it's not working as well. And that automated account I eventually closed, I think probably in 2010, because it wasn't making money anymore. I wasn't fast enough to, you know, my computer systems weren't fast enough to make money with it. But you know what? As a human being, I still had a definitive advantage because I have, you know, any automated computer system that's, you know, trading on a program, that has to be programmed in and figured out where a human being can, you know, change their thinking on the fly. The program can't think for itself. It's just going to do what it's made to do. So, you know, I think that's why, you know, I'm still profitable today is because I'm always, you know, quickly adapting to the new environment. And I would say I actually use a lot less automation than I did 10 years ago. And that's counterintuitive because a lot of people and a lot of traders say, oh, you can't trade, you know, unless you're automated now. I would say you're late to the curve. Automation, the party was back into the early, mid-2000s for your regular Joe. And, you know, now I would say any automated systems that I run are very difficult because I'm competing against the fastest firms in the world. And, you know, only one firm can win the race. So, you know, there's 5-6 firms dominating that space. There's a lot of other high-frequency trading firms. There's 5 or 6 probably dominating it. So, and I can't compete with those. And, you know, they have, you know, not even speed. They have relationship trades where, you know, where they've got payment for order flow. They're sending, you know, orders, you know, buying order flow from retail brokers so they can have the first chance to interact with those orders. There's a lot going on. So, you know, I think I went on a pretty good tangent here, but back to your original question. When my automated systems weren't working as well, probably in 2010, 2011, I realized, hey, I've got to do some adjustments here. And then, you know, my scalping strategies weren't working anymore because I can't get filled with my bids or offers because, you know, there's other traders that are quote matching me and beating me to the price. So I adjusted and I went from from being mainly a scalper to adjusting my time frame from seconds probably up to minutes. So I'm still not trading in hours. I'm still not trading in days, but I'm probably trading in, you know, minutes, maybe, you know, up to a little bit longer than that. But, you know, there's still a lot of advantages for a human trader, just not in the scalping world.
Okay, so just to summarize what you've said there, essentially you're saying that scalping isn't a viable strategy any longer?
Not for a human being, no. And not even most of your automated programs, because, like I said, I was running automated scalping strategies for 5-6 years, from probably 2005, and I might be getting the dates wrong, but, you know, mid-2000s up till 2010, 2011, my automated systems weren't making money anymore either. So, and it's just because market making is all about, you know, getting filled on the bid and filled on the offer. And when there's participants, you know, we can jump into some of this, but a lot of your order flow is now going off exchange. And you have, you know, it's funny, everybody talks about the speed race, but really, you know, it's about relationships as well. And, you know, you have a retail broker that routes orders out to an off exchange market maker. That off exchange market maker has the first chance to interact with those orders. And nobody competing with them. Those orders go through their platform first. So they're going to have the chance to match my quote. So if I bid a stock at $24.50, well, it might trade at my price again and again and again, and I might not get filled because the order that's trying to interact with my $24.50 bid is being routed off exchange and executed directly against, you know, by another, you know, probably a high-frequency off-exchange market maker. So it's very, very difficult for, you know, a human being and, you know, even an automated system, you know, to compete with that. So in a market-making capacity or scalping capacity, it's nearly impossible to compete with those top-tier firms.
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, when we're talking about scalping here, we're referring to equity markets, right? So futures,
yeah,
and that sort of thing is a different story altogether, right?
Different markets, and I'm an equities trader, so I'm not even going to comment on, you know, how that's changed. You know, I can imagine how it's changed in the futures markets as well, but, you know, I've always been an equities trader. I've dabbled into the futures markets there, but I never had any luck with it. I've always been an equities trader for 17 years, and you kind of stick with what you know best. So the equities markets, there's a lot of market fragmentation. When I was starting, like I said, 1999, 80 or 90% of your order flow went through the New York Stock Exchange, went through the guy standing on the floor. are. Now, you know, there's 15 or 20% only going through that, and there's 11 other venues where, you know, these trades can transact. So when I bid a stock, for instance, and this would be a good example, like a small cap stock, it doesn't apply as much on the real mega caps, but you think about a small cap stock, it's maybe got a market of 2450 to 2475. If I wanted to tighten that market, go 2451, there's going to be an automated program that automatically steps ahead of me at 2452. I go 2453, they're going to bid 2454 instantaneously. So they're trying, you know, to be, you know, it's all queue priority. They want to be at the top of the order queue. Or they're just going to match my quote, and then, you know, so a lot of times you'll see 2450, I'll bid, then five other exchanges will bid along with me. I'll cancel, they'll all cancel too. They all want to lean on my quote, and that's really what market making is. It's kind of leaning on the quote for protection. So I've been 2450, they've been 2451, somebody comes in, sell it to them at 2451. If the going gets tough, S&P futures start tanking, they hit me at 2450, lose a penny. So do you follow me on that? And if I'm talking too fast, just slow me down.
No, it's excellent.
But you can just see how everything has evolved and changed where, you know, okay, so that's called the algorithmic penny jumpers. Those are prevalent in the small caps. But then also, you know, to top it all off, a lot of your small caps, this is why the small cap space in the U.S. is a complete mess. So I bid 2450. Let's say nobody else bids ahead of me. I can bid there all day at 2450. Somebody comes in from a retail broker trying to hit me at 2450, so they're trying to trade against my order. Well, that gets routed out to, you know, an off-exchange market maker that then actually has the, you know, the luxury of being able to match my quote. So they're going to trade and maybe give them some small sub-penny price improvement, just a fraction above me, but they're leaning on my quote for protection as well. So really, in the small cap space and even in the big caps, for the most part, the quote now is just been, you know, being used to lean on by everybody else. Everybody that's gotten, you know, an advantage over you by speed or by relationships. So really, by me sitting out there with my 2450 bid, trying to make a market, you know, taking the risk. So my 2450 bid, I'm the first guy there. I'm the guy taking the risk, but I'm not getting the reward of getting the execution. The only time I get filled is when the thing blows through when he has 2440 offer in my face. So you know what I do? I say, no, I'm not going to bid my 2450. Not going to give them my quote to lean on here because, you know, they're using it against me. So I'm not going to bid at all. So what I've done in my trading strategies, and this is the number one thing I've done to survive in this world, and, you know, this is, you know, goes beyond a lot of traders even, but what I do is instead of, you know, providing liquidity, and that's why when you sit out there with your passive limit order, what you're really doing is providing liquidity. Instead, I take liquidity. So, you know, when the spread tightens, if I was trading some small cap, I would lift the offer or hit the bid. Or maybe I'll go midpoint because sometimes I get a fill. But for the most part, especially when I'm trading the mega caps, I never sit my orders out there because they're going to use those against you. I want to just hit the bid or lift the offer. And that's why I now focus on the mega caps because most of those have 1 cent spreads. So I consider that like your high frequency trading toll. Basically, because they monopolize scalping, they monopolize the spread, they've brought it back, you know, from, it's kind of went full circle when I think about it. You know, on the floor they used to have, you know, the monopoly on the spread. Then, you know, it went to the e-traders that kind of took it away from them. Now it's kind of went all full circle. It went off exchange, it's doing some different things, but they monopolize the spread again. So basically when I'm talking spread, I'm talking the difference between the bid and the ask, just in case we have some newer listeners there. But, you know, that used to be my payday. That's how I got paid, was making the spread. Now, you know, I can't because I can't compete with those systems. So they're forcing me to pay the spread. So if they're going to force me to pay the spread, well, I'm going to trade the stocks with the tightest spread so I don't have to pay very much. And that's, you know, like your Bank Americas, like your Johnson & Johnson's, like your General Electric's, like your Procter & Gamble's. Those kind of stocks have a penny spread, and I can get in and out of them with relative ease with some size.
Okay, so I want to pick up on some things you're saying there. What sort of orders are you actually using in your trading today? Like, what type of orders are you using?
Okay, so I would say marketable limit orders, but I'm not, you know, so the difference between a market order and a marketable limit order is it's your price is set. So for instance, let's say I'm trading General Electric, I want to buy GE. It's 29, or I'll just bring it up here right now, give you the current quote. So it closed at 30.23. Let's say it's 30.23 to 30.24. So if I'm going to go in GE, am I going to join the bid at 30.23 and try to save the penny? I could do that, but what will happen is I probably won't be filled until it's 30.22 to 30.23, so until the quote actually rolls through my bid. That means, you know, that the bid has now become the offer. So I'm paying the spread anyways. So why not just lift the offer and make sure I get the trade? I always say don't miss a trade to save a penny. And that's really what you're doing. Now, the likelihood you're probably going to get filled, you're probably going to get filled. But what if you don't? What if your bid was the low of the day? Now, you know, that's a huge opportunity cost. So the opportunity cost is too great in this environment for me to miss a trade to try to save a penny. So if I want to get in that, it's 30.23 to 30.24. I'm going to use a limit order of 30.24. I'm going to send a buy order with a limit price of 30.24. Maybe if I'm really aggressive and I really want to be in, I'll send a buy order with a limit price of 30.25. And, you know, I'm probably still going to get the 30.24 because if the best offer is there, they've got to route me there anyway. So it depends how aggressive I want to be. But I'm basically using that price. The reason I don't send a flat-out market order is because we're in a high-frequency trading world where quotes can change very quickly. And that's like writing a blank check. So if I just send a market order to buy GE, maybe I can fill the 30-30. And maybe something happens in that time frame that from when I click the button till, you know, my order actually gets to the exchange, you know, that I don't want to happen. Maybe I don't want to own that at 30-30. So that's why I never use market orders. I didn't use market orders back in 1999. I don't use them today. Bright Trading's taught me it's like writing a blank check. I always want to put a price on my order. So that's what I'm using as a marketable limit order. So instead of joining the bid with a passive limit order, a marketable limit order is an order that's the – so a marketable order is any order that's actually trying to lift the offer. So if the offer price is 30.24 and I send a buy price at 30.24, that is a marketable limit order. I'm trying to lift the offer.
Okay, so I'm not quite sure that I understand the difference between a marketable limit order and a normal standard limit order.
A normal standard, well, and it is just a limit order. It's just a type of limit order.
So okay, it's the same
a
thing.
Normal limit order, yeah. So a 30.23, if the I'll just give you another example. So same thing. 30.23 to 30.24 is the Merck and General Electric. If I put a limit order to buy it at 30.23, that is a standing limit order. That's a normal limit order. Both are limit orders, but because I'm not going to get executed immediately, that is why it's not marketable. So I'm just going to sit and join the bid because the bid is 30.23. You know, if I'm on whatever exchange I am, I'm going to be behind price time priority. So if there's 10,000 shares been at 30.23, I'm going to be behind those 10,000 shares. So that's why, you know, I'm actually, you know, putting myself kind of to the back of the order queue. And like I said, in a high-frequency trading world, they basically monopolize the top of the order queue. So my order is always going to be at the back of the queue anyways. So basically the difference, though, between the limit and the marketable limit is when I'm setting a marketable order, it's for immediate execution. I'm trying to actually take the offer. It's offered at 30.24. I'm trying to grab the 30.24 offer, lift it.
Okay.
Do you follow me?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the difference. Both are limit orders, though.
Right. So is a marketable limit order, is that something that's available through most retail trading platforms?
It's just a regular limit order. So you would just say, you know, I'm calling it a marketable order because that's what it's actually called when you try to lift it. But you can just say for simplicity purposes, it's a limit order. I'm putting a limit on my price. So, you know, it's called, you know, technical definition because the offer is 30.24 and I'm putting a bid at 30.24. I'm trying to lift the offer. That's why it's called a marketable order. That's just technical jargon, though. It's just a regular limit order where I'm trying to lift the offer.
Makes sense. Okay, so one of the things I want to dig into a little bit more and ask you about is what is it about trading the open that really appeals to you? Like, where do you see your edge coming from during the first few minutes of the session? Why do you like trading the open?
I love the open, and I will tell you that I probably make at least 50% of my money in the first 5 minutes of the day. Why is that? The open is the price discovery phase of the markets. I love price discovery. And you know why else? Because your high-frequency traders hate price discovery because they, you know, besides the ones that are actually trying to move the prices, your passive market-making high-frequency trading systems are hands-off at the open because there's a lot of risk. And imagine you being a high-frequency trader and you have your profit margin is fractions of a cent, like a half a cent. All of a sudden, you know, buy a stock like Microsoft, and it falls 20 cents on you. Well, you're in big trouble. If your average, you know, profit margin is only half a cent, you can't be taking risk on that, you know, where the stock moves 20, 30 cents in the opening bar. The opening bar meaning the first minute or, you know, depending on what, you know, chart you're using. But you can't be taking on that risk. So the high-frequency traders are kind of hands-off. I always want to be trading, you know, when they're not around because they're competition. there's not that much competition at the open. You know, there's a lot of price dislocations as well, because you have institutions that are coming in. There's orders, you know, that have been sent from the night before, even from little retail traders. They all pull them together. And the other thing about the open that I like, especially on the New York Stock Exchange stocks, is that's the one time a day where the designated market maker, the specialist that I was talking about before, and they call them designated market makers now, that's where they actually are putting together that opening print. They have some automated help with it, but there is actually still a human element of involvement with that opening print. So a lot what I talked about and Don Bright taught us back, you know, in 1999 still applies. You can try to get on the same side as maybe that guy on the floor, and there might be an advantage to doing that. But basically, the open, there's going to be the biggest chance. And if you look at any chart, intraday chart, a lot of times that opening bar, you see the biggest, most volatility. That's what I like. You know, that's where the most action is, and that's where the most chance of you know, making a decent profit. Like, if I've traded GE during the middle of the day from, like, noon, the thing moves to, you know, if the S&P futures aren't bouncing around, if they're just staying still, GE's trading in a 1 cent range. Well, as a scalper, that's great, but if you're not a scalper, that's not very good. You can't kind of make money on a 1 cent range. I was saying earlier, you know, the high frequency traders are making that 1 cent. You're paying that 1 cent. So if it's only moving a penny, you know, back and forth between 30.23 and 30.24, there's no money for me to be made. But at the open, there's a lot of movement. Even on a stock like GE, there might be a 10, 15, 20 cent run. And, you know, and then it goes into different types of trading. Like, I prepare for the open 3 hours before it actually opens. So my trading day doesn't start at 9:30. My trading day starts at 6:30 in the morning, and my trading day actually starts the night before. So if I look even for my notes here, my notes for tomorrow. So I've been watching the after-hours action to know what to trade tomorrow, because I'm watching what the news is, what stocks are moving. So I've gathering a lot of information. I'm trying to inform myself. I want to be an informed trader on that open. And, you know, once I have that information, I can, you know, try to put a projection on where I feel that stock should open, where fair value, where I've deemed the fair value of that stock. If the stock opens way above the fair value, I'll short it. If it opens way below the fair value, I'll buy it. And I'll do that on a number of stocks. You know, sometimes I send 50, 200, you know, orders there at the open. So, and, you know, I use a little bit of automation to help me do that, because it's tedious to do it manually. But some of my best ones are manual. And, you know, I'm sending all these orders in there, trying to, you know, get these opening print. And the opening, I use mostly OPG orders. And what an OPG order is, it's an opening order that says to give me the opening print or immediately cancel the order. So that I'm not sitting out there like a sitting duck. You know, if I have, you know, a limit order out there and I forget it out there, market tanks, I'm going to get picked off and lose some money. So the OPG order is nice. It just gives you the opening print, or it automatically cancels that. So GE, hypothetical example, GE is trading at 30.23, close at 30.23. S&P futures are opening up 1% tomorrow. GE's beta is approximately 1. So it moves approximately with the market. So if that's the case, 30 cents would be about 1% move. So I would say maybe the fair value of General Electric is $30.53. I might put an order to buy GE below that fair value. Say I'm going to buy at 30.40. I'm going to put an order to sell short GE maybe at 30.65, both OPG orders. If it opens at 30.70, I'm going to get 30.70 short. If it opens at 30.60, I'm not going to get filled. The order is going to automatically cancel. So it all just depends on, you know, how I price those opening orders. But, you know, if a stock opens too high or too low, a lot of times it will draw back into where that fair value is. That's a simplistic example. Now, there's a whole bunch of stuff that complicates that, you know, where trades can get crowded and other fun things can happen. But that's the basic strategy around the open, is projecting where the fair value of the stock is and selling it short if it opens too high, or buying it if it opens too low.
Okay, and did I hear you correctly when you said you might place between 50 to 200 orders, like 200 trades on the open?
Orders, so not necessarily getting fills on those. I'm placing orders where, you know, they're going to fill or they're going to cancel. So when I'm placing an order, a lot of stocks will open right around, you know, where their fair value is. So I'm not going to get filled on those orders. But I would say, you know, back, you know, going a few years ago, I'd probably easily place 300 to 400 orders prior to the open, opening only orders, and maybe get filled on 20 stocks, 20, 30 stocks. And then I would trade out of those positions, all in the opening print. First minute, I got 25 positions. Okay, let's go. You know, let's, you know, and sometimes, you know, something funny happens, like on an option expiration, I could fill in like 75 orders. So now I've got like 75 positions. Okay, now this is fun. You know, when I get filled on that many positions, I don't even care about the individual positions. All I care about is my net market exposure. So what I would then look is, okay, I'm long $1 million worth of stock. I need to hedge myself here because I'm trying to extract the alpha from the misprice opening. If the S&P futures tank on me and I'm long $1 million worth of stock, the alpha's gone. So what I want to do is sell short an equivalent amount of SPY to the beta of my portfolio. So, you know, there's a lot of figuring that goes on in this, but, you know, a lot of math behind it all. But basically, you know, if I'm long $1 million worth of stock, I'm going to sell short $1 million worth of SPY. And now I'm hedged. Now I'm market neutral. Now I can let, you know, my arbitrage portfolio, because I probably, you know, bought a whole bunch of stocks that opened too low relative to where the futures were. Now I can let the natural arbitrage bring it in and slowly work out of those positions. But, you know, if I'm long one or two or three positions, I'll just trade out of them and not even hedge it. But if I get long 20, 30, 40 different positions, or I'm too unbalanced, like if I'm long 20 stocks and short 20 stocks, that's a natural hedge in itself. But if I'm long 20 stocks and short none, that's where I've got a lot of market exposure. And I like to trade market neutral, where I'm always eliminating the market risk, because market, you know, tanks here in the next 2 seconds, I'm not positioned for that. So that's the whole key with almost all of my strategies, is trading market neutral. And that sounds crazy to a lot of people because they think the market's got to move to make money. But I'm trying to extract that inefficiency of where a stock is open too high or too low. So that's the alpha that I'm extracting from the market, is that inefficiency of the opening print. And the opening print is often inefficient. I mean, one institution that says, hey, I want to buy this stock, and they put in a buy order to buy 500,000 shares, might press the stock up way too high. Or one institution might, you know, say, I want to sell 500,000 shares in the open. That might push the stock way too low. I'll provide liquidity to those orders. And then, you know, and that's the alpha that I'm extracting, is, you know, I'm providing a service really to that institutional order by providing liquidity to it, so that, you know, their order isn't going to, you know, there's going to be less price impact with their order. And I'm not the only trader doing this. All the other prop firms are doing this too. So, you know, as a whole, those stock, you know, isn't going to open nearly as low as it would without those liquidity providers.
The interview will continue in just one moment, guys. Right now, let's give a big thanks to our sponsor, TradeStation. TradeStation is a very reputable, fully licensed online broker who have history dating back to 1982. So if you're in the market for a broker, pun intended, here's three things to consider. TradeStation's award-winning platform is a major selling point, as many users will tell you, due to its sheer power and support of customization, which has only been amplified since the launch of the TradeStation Trading App Store. To continue, TradeStation's analysis tools are on point, especially their radar screen, which allows you to dynamically scan up to 1,000 symbols in real time for any criteria which you define. Third of all, TradeStation are big on delivering research and education to their clients, with regular webinars, on-demand video tutorials, and more to help you stay ahead. I could keep going, but your best bet is to visit TradeStation.com to see everything they have to offer there. Again, visit TradeStation.com to learn why traders trade with TradeStation. So you said that you use some sort of automation to enter those orders, enter into those positions sometimes. If you're filled on, you know, what could be up to maybe 70 different trades, do you also use some automation to help you exit those positions, or is that all done by hand?
We have proprietary software that will do that. I don't. I've always been a fan of I don't use that as much automation, like I said, as nearly as I used to. So going back to 2005, 2006, I used a lot of automation. I kind of, you know, pick and choose my spots now more from a manual perspective. So where I was sending, you know, hundreds on hundreds of orders before, a lot of times I might only be sending 30 or 40 or 50 orders before, and I can easily place those manually. So your original question, though, I went on the tangent. I forgot your original question there, Aaron.
Do you use any automation to exit out of if you get filled on, say, 70 positions or something like that?
No, I would just go and do exactly what I did, hedge it. If you had the automated software, and I'm sure, you know, if this high-frequency trader is running these similar strategies, they might just automate out, and maybe they don't hedge it. You know, maybe they can just easily, quickly trade out of those positions because they can send 70 orders. The computer systems can do that. But, you know, I don't like doing that. I like to work out of them because I always feel like I can work the trade better. You know, like I'm figuring... I used to figure, you know, like I made hundreds and thousands of trades. Like, I mean, you know, and you know, sometimes, you know, some days I would make 1,000 trades. So, you know, I've got a lot of trading experience, so I feel like I can, you know, work out of those trades better just because of my own 17 years of experience. So that's why I do the hedging technique where I kind of automate in to get those. You know, if I need to, you know, get a lot of orders out there, I will use some automation to do it. And then I would hedge myself by just, you know, selling short or buying the SPY, whatever equivalent, to get myself dollar neutral. And then I can slowly manually work out of those positions over the course of the next half an hour. So I don't have to be out immediately. The hedge allows me not to have to automate out.
Right, right. And is that where the remaining 50% of your money might come in from during the rest of the day while exiting out of those positions? You said that.
Yeah. And if I talked about my trading day, so obviously, you know, I said my trading day starts very early. And I'll trade pre-market too. So I think something's mispriced pre-market, I'll buy it. You know, if I think something's mispriced, you know, I'll short it too. It depends. You know, if it's not where my fair value is calculated out, I'm not scared to trade in the pre-market or after hours, you know, if I think something's mispriced. But I would say, like I said, the majority of my money is probably made in the first 5 to 10 minutes. You know, not majority, but 50% at least. And then, you know, maybe some throughout the day. But I'll tell you, at least in the U.S. markets, I know, the world markets are all different. Between 11 and 2, I don't even trade at all. 11 p.m., 2 p.m., I call it toxic. Those are your toxic hours, where all you got is high-frequency traders trading with other high-frequency traders, and for the most part, all the inefficiencies that, you know, I'm interested in don't exist. They've been, you know, the high-frequency traders are all over any inefficiency that's happening those hours. So between 11 and 2, or even, I would say, even I've extended that, between 10:30 and 2:30, 10:30 a.m., 2:30 p.m., I usually take an extended lunch. I'll go do some other stuff. You know, maybe, you know, go out for, you know, with a friend or, you know, or do an interview or something. You know, I'm going to do something different. So 11 to 2, middle of the trading day, there's just not enough inefficiencies for me to extract to be bothered with. So that's kind of my time off in the middle of the day.
Okay, so you come back in at the close. Do you take
any positions? Yeah, 2:30, 2:30, 3 o'clock. Come back in, get ready for the close. New information is happening. You know, I've got, you know, there's the at 2 o'clock you have pre-market closing imbalances that start coming out. And that's, you know, a whole other topic we could talk about is the imbalance information. And this information, you know, is now, if you're a retail trader, it's amazing, you know, the information that's out there. You can subscribe to this different information out there. Most retail traders don't know it exists. But it's actually all, you know, everything that was available to us in 1999 as a prop firm is pretty much available to the retail guy today. You just got to know where to look for it. But, you know, there's closing imbalances, which are your institutional orders that are getting logged in, and they're showing you, you know, like today, for instance, was a great day for closing imbalances. It was the end of the month, and that's often a big day for the close. So the best days for the close and for the open, for that matter, are end of month, end of the quarter, on any rebalancing day where, you know, indexes are rebalancing, and on the third Friday, the options expiration. Those are the big days for the openings and the closing. Those are the best days. And today, this was one of the best closes I've seen in a long time, where you actually had a lot of stocks trading with some serious buy imbalances and sell imbalances. One of the imbalances, so you have institutions that are sending orders that say they're limit on close orders that say buy me GE or market on close orders even, where buy me 100,000 shares of GE at the closing price. And then you have another institution that says sell me 100,000 shares of GE at the closing price. That would net out. But if you had an institution that said buy 100,000 shares of GE at the closing price and another that said sell 50,000 shares at the closing price, there would be a net buy imbalance of 50,000 shares. That information is publicly available and gets, you know, publicly advertised to everyone at 3:45. But there's services that actually offer that information ahead of time as well. As early as 2 o'clock, that information starts coming out. So if you know there's a lot of buyers on the close, it could potentially push the price of the stock higher. If you know there's a lot of sellers on the close, it could potentially push the price of the stock lower. Why is that? Because traders are going to buy ahead of it or sell ahead of it. So if, you know, there's a huge buy imbalance, and for instance, today is a great example. It don't always work like this, but it worked well today. In Berkshire Hathaway, which is BRK.B, there was a 700,000 share sell imbalance at the close. And if you bring up the chart of that, it actually shows going from 142.50 in the last minute, that thing falls 2 points in the last minute. That is just pure order flow based. There's no, you know, people, and you'll have news media calling up and saying, what happened in Berkshire Hathaway? You know, there was, we saw it fall. You know, did Warren Buffett get sick? What happened there? But it was nothing to do with anything fundamental with the company. It was all to do with order flow. And there was just a huge seller. There was a huge bunch of institutional sellers at the close. And that drove the price down 2 points. That was a huge move for Berkshire Hathaway. That's a nice arbitrage opportunity because S&P futures didn't tank that much, but Berkshire did. So if you see after hours, it's already started to bounce back. But that is, you know, the advantage of, you know, having that order flow information is that you see those closing imbalances and, you know, you can actually, you know, trade on that information. It's publicly available. So this huge seller is going to be on the closing print. It could drive down the closing print. Back in the day, that was, you know, a slam dunk. Now it's not that easy. I would say 90% of the time those orders will pair off or, you know, they just – and pair off, I mean, that another institution would come in and say buy the 700,000 shares or, you know, that it just won't move the stock that much. Just so happens at the end of the month, sometimes the liquidity isn't there, and it really was able to drive that price down. If I look at Microsoft, for instance, same thing, going the opposite way. If you look at Microsoft, huge green candle end of the day, gapped up 50 cents on the closing print. This is Microsoft, one of the biggest companies in the world. It gapped up 1% on the closing print because of a huge buy imbalance. That is a tradable event. That is something that I'm, you know, all about, extracting the alpha from that event. And, you know, it's just an inefficiency. There, you know, should it trade up 50 cents at the close? No, it shouldn't. It's just trading up because there was a huge buyer at the close pushing the price out. So what I would do is probably sell that stock short and then try to cover it the next day.
Okay, so I guess we should probably point out that we're recording this interview the evening, obviously after the close, on the 31st of May 2016, if anyone wants to look that up on the chart. And also want to ask you, where can, you know, your everyday trader get access to this information that you're talking about? Like, what are some of the services that are available?
I believe some of your retail brokers offer it. I think Interactive Brokers has. And, like, I'm on a prop firm, so, you know, I'm getting this information through my proprietary direct feed. So I'm not trading retail, so I can't speak exactly for each retail trader. But I know, like, Mr. Top Step, he'll probably like the shout-out there if he's going to listen to it. But, you know, he's got an early feed. Great, you know, Danny Riley there, great guy at Mr. Top Step. He offers it. Rosenblatt Securities offers another one. So, you know, there's another one, you know, a place where you can get that information. And it's not expensive. I mean, and that's the one thing about me. And, you know, I think it keeps me profitable too, is you'll have a trader and they're scared to spend money. You got to spend money to make money. And I probably drop $1,000 a month in information. And you've got it. You can't be scared. You can't be say, whoa, I got to, you know, make $12,000 a year to break even. We can't be scared about that. You need that information to make money. And I just think, you know, if you're paying $100 a month for an early imbalance feed and you get one trade off that, it pays for itself. So, you know, I've got different some of this stuff comes to me through the platform itself, through the Goldman Sachs platform. But, you know, I've also, you know, got different scanners and filtering systems that are looking for opportunities. I'm running a NeoVest scanner. I'm running MadScan. I'm running my own proprietary scanners that I've built myself. Like, and I'm not a programmer, but that I've had built for me by other programmers. So I'm scanning the market looking for information and opportunities to trade. So I'm not just sitting here. You know, I make money off of information. I would say, you know, if I'm really analyzing myself, I'm more of like making money on almost all of my strategies, I would say, from information arbitrage, like looking, you know, at the information and then extracting, you know, alpha from that information, all publicly available information.
Yeah, yeah, right. So just a couple last questions before we close this out. Seeing as you're a market structure guy and the term high frequency trading has been sort of flying around this interview a little bit, one of the things you said to me before we hit the record button was that a lot of people try to blanket HFT as either good or bad, but you sort of have the opinion that that's not really the case, that there's, you know, some HFT which is positive, a positive impact for the market, and then there's some which is perhaps predatory. Could you just tell us a little bit about where you stand on the sort of the controversial HFT debate?
Yeah, that's exactly it. You've got to look at the strategy. So there's going to be, and just like in the pit and the bad day, there's always, you know, bad, you know, traders. But the pit, the nice thing about the pit, if you go back in like the 90s, the pit would self-police itself. There was somebody, you know, doing some, you know, like, you know, trying to fool you or doing some different stuff. You know, they're going to, you know, the pit isn't going to allow that. The traders can see, you know, who's doing this. They're not going to trade with that guy anymore. Or they're going to take him out back and beat him up. You know, it's a lot different where now you have so much everything's anonymous. You don't know these players. You just see their orders out there. But, you know, a lot of, you know, different strategies there that are trying to, you know, trick other traders. And, you know, and so that's why you've got to look and really break up, you know, what is, you know, the strategy, and is that, you know, good or bad for the market? So I wouldn't say, you can't say, oh, high frequency trader is good for the market, high frequency trading is bad for the market. You gotta say, what's the strategy, and is that good for the market or bad for the market? And, you know, a lot of the high frequency trading market making, you know, is definitely beneficial to the market. You know, these 1 cent, you know, spreads and stuff. You know, you can argue, you know, and this gets a little bit, you know, going maybe beyond some of the listeners, but I've argued in the past that maybe we're too reliant on high frequency trading liquidity, where now I would say the majority of your liquidity, so your bids and offers that are out there in the book, that will absorb, you know, a sudden, you know, price impact or, you know, event, are high frequency traders. So where before, if you look at the floor, you had a lot of different types of traders providing liquidity to the market. Even, you know, me myself, I said I used to be a high liquidity provider. I'm not anymore. I'm a liquidity taker. So now you're probably very reliant on high frequency traders for liquidity, and that's one concern for me, is there's no affirmative obligations, so they can just cancel quotes and you get left with a vacuum. It's often what you see during these flash crash events, simply just not enough liquidity in the book to absorb the excess supply that's coming into the market. So, you know, that's, you know, but, you know, if you're going back to your original question, is high frequency trading good or bad for the market? A lot of it's beneficial. The market making aspect is for sure. The stuff where, you know, you get into is the more predatory market making that I don't like, which I talked about the penny jumping earlier, or the off exchange stuff where you have an off exchange market maker leaning on somebody else's quote for protection. I think that just discourages the original liquidity in the first place. I think that's something where, you know, is probably not as helpful as, you know, if that market maker was actually quoting in the lit market. So basically, when I'm talking off exchange market making, is they don't actually have to provide any bids or offers. They can simply match the bids and offers that are out there. So they're not taking on nearly as much risk. And that's where, you know, I do have a little bit of an issue with that type of market making as well. So I'm not sure that that benefits as much as if those participants were quoting in the lit market, the public exchange. But, you know, you're looking at other things like layering, and layering is a strategy where you put fake orders out there, maybe some sizable orders, trying to, you know, say, okay, well, you see some size, then, you know, other systems might actually sell the stock, thinking, you know, oh, there's some big sellers in the market, we're going to sell the stock, and, you know, it was a fake order. So, you know, you've heard a lot about layering in the past, and something like that can be automated very easily and probably, you know, very harmful to the market, because it's trying to trick other traders into, you know, buying or selling off of information that isn't real. So, you know, that's another example of maybe a strategy that's probably not beneficial for the market. So, but like I said, a lot of the strategies in themselves, the arbitrage is there. It makes the market more efficient. So, you know, for the most part, your high-frequency trader is employing arbitrage. It just simply makes the price more efficient. It gets to where it is faster. So that's probably beneficial. A lot of the market making is beneficial besides some of the off-exchange market making or some of this algorithmic penny jumping in the small caps. But for the most part, a lot of the high-frequency trading, you know, strategies, there's probably a lot of really good firms out there doing a lot of good, but they need to crack down on the stuff that's more predatory.
Okay, okay. Awesome answer, Dennis. Thank you very much. One last question. Is there any advice you'd like to leave with anyone listening who might still be learning the ropes today?
Yeah, and obviously, you know, I've traded for a lot of years now. You know, I helped educate the traders at Bright Trading, the new one. So it's those adjustments that you need to make. So, you know, for, you know, if you're trading in a high frequency trading world, which we are, we can't control the environment that we trade in, so we have to adjust to it. The adjustments that I've made to stay profitable, and I think, you know, whenever I see other traders that are struggling, when they start to employ some of these adjustments, actually a lot of these traders actually start to turn it around. So number one thing, which I talked about before, is I'm a liquidity taker. I don't provide liquidity. I don't sit my bids out there hoping that the price comes to me, because it often will come to your price, you'll miss your fill, and it'll quickly go the other way, especially in a small cap stock. It's very dangerous to just have sitting limit orders out there. I say when you have a sitting limit, you're a sitting duck. You're a sitting duck to get picked off by a more informed trader. So I take liquidity as opposed to providing liquidity. On that same note, scalping is no longer a viable strategy. If you're jumping in, trying to make a penny or two on a trade, you're going to just commission yourself to death for one thing. The second thing you're going to do is you're just not going to be able to compete with those high-frequency traders that are co-located or that have a speed advantage for you or a relationship advantage, and you're not going to be able to be profitable with that strategy. So scalping, no longer a viable strategy, not even for some of your automation. So you can say, I'll get automated, I'll scalp. Like I said, I ran this automated scalping system for a lot of years, and it's not profitable anymore either. So I say scalping, leave it up to the high-frequency traders. So lengthen your time horizon. Don't think about your trade in seconds or milliseconds. Think about it in minutes are okay. Hours are even better. If you're trading in swing trading environment, days to weeks, there's nobody. There's no competition in there. So because that's, you know, going on, you know, looking at trends and looking at a lot of different things. And we didn't even touch on the technical analysis, but, you know, that's something I employ on my swing trades as well. And there's a lot to that. So, you know, reading a chart from, you know, an intraday perspective and understanding, you know, different levels and, you know, where stocks, you know, tend to have support or resistance or where they're trending, that's all viable still. Just not having that short time frame, that's what will kill you. Another thing is, you know, don't show your hand. So if you're sitting there and when the way you're trading and you're putting your bid out there and then you're canceling, and you're putting another bid out and you're canceling, there's be high-frequency trading systems, predatory ones, that are going to log that. And they're going to say, hey, we got a fresh one. This guy really wants to buy this stock right now. And they might try to buy it ahead of you and make you pay the most price. So that's why I'm a big fan of just lifting the offer or hitting the bid as quickly as you can. If you're putting a lot of, you know, passive eliminators and trying to work the order, they might figure out what you're doing. And, you know, that's going to be used to your disadvantage. And then the other thing is, you know, just remember that, obviously, you have a big advantage as a human being is that you can change your thinking on a dime. Any automated computer system there has to be programmed in, and, you know, they can't adjust on the fly like that. So that's the biggest advantage of being a human is that you can quickly adjust, you know, your thinking or your strategy for the current environment. And, you know, strategies change and, you know, different types of trades work in different types of trading environments. So you have to understand the environment that you're in. When you're a 5-year bull run, you know, it's the shorts are going to be tougher. When you're in a market that's, you know, for the last year just kind of oscillating, well, range-bound trading is going to work better now. So, you know, that's an advantage, you know, and even looking at different time frames, you know, maybe, you know, the last day or two we're trending down. Well, you know, I can adjust my strategies on the fly where somebody running an automated system can't adjust as easily.
Great, great. Awesome advice there, Dennis. And where can listeners go to find out more about you?
Yeah, so I do a radio show every morning for Benzinga. It's called Benzinga's Pre-Market Prep Show. And you can just Google Pre-Market Prep and you'll find us. We're on every morning from 8 a.m. Eastern till 9:30 Eastern. I'm on from 8:05 till 8:55, and then I have to go prepare for my open. So I always get off 35 minutes before the open so I can get all these opening orders out there. Because one thing I've learned is, when you're doing a radio show and you're trading, that doesn't work very well. So, you know, trying to trade and do a live radio show, don't do that. So, Aaron, when you're interviewing traders or doing a live radio show and you're trying to trade at the same time, that's a recipe for disaster because trading takes full concentration. So from 8:05 to 8:55, I don't do a lot of trading. I do the Benzinga radio show. And I'm on there with Joel Alkonen, who was my mentor, who I started with back in 1999. And we've got the Benzinga news team, who is great. Benzinga's great, Jason Rasnick, behind it. And, you know, we've got quite a few listeners. So we've got we got an active chat room there where you can come in and chat with us. You ask us questions. And, you know, we talk all this stuff. You know, we basically go through, you know, what's moving here today, what we see. I try to identify the sectors that I think are going to be strong, sectors that are going to be weak. We're all trying to prepare our traders for the market open. So I'm giving you that information that I'm using in my own trading and trying to, you know, help you guys out with your trading as well. Again, sharing all the capital intensive stuff because, like I said, you know, if it's something really small, I'm not going to, you know, just, you know, hand that out because then, you know, I'm just, you know, taking money from my own pot. But, you know, if something's capital intensive where, you know, there's, you know, millions of dollars, you know, that's a huge trade where there's millions of dollars available and I'm not going to take it all, I can share that stuff, you know, and I don't mind trying to help traders. I've been in it for, you know, 17 years here now, so I like to help traders and I like to see traders turn around and succeed.
Absolutely. So where's the best place to find that out? Are we best just Google it, or is there a URL you want to give out?
Yeah, I wish they got a better URL. They haven't. So it's if I just gave you the URL on the Pre-Market Prep Show, it's Pre-Market, PreMarket.Benzinga.com. And then, so you can go there, or you just Google Pre-Market, Benzinga, Pre-Market Prep, Pre-Market Dennis Dick, if you want, you'll find us. So,
cool. Well, I'll put a link to that
really quickly.
Yeah, I'll put a link to that in the show notes anyway, so that's easy for listeners to find. And you're also on Twitter as well. Do you want to give out your handle?
Yeah, Triple D Trader. So TRIPLE, the letter D, Trader, TRADER. So Triple D Trader, and yeah, I tweet, and I was tweeting a lot about the imbalances here today. I wanted the tweets a little bit at the open, a little bit at the close. I don't tweet that much during the day. I probably tweet, you know, 3 or 4 times a day. I'm not a huge tweeter, but I try to, like, when I tweet something, I try to make it relevant or, you know, something important. So, like, I'll tweet, like, when the S&P additions or deletions or something come on, something that's going to be potentially market moving, I try to tweet it out.
Sure, sure. Okay. No, sounds good. All right, Dennis, well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, man. I really appreciate it, and you've given us a lot to think about. So, yeah, let's definitely stay in touch.
Okay, thanks, Aaron.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.